But I just wanted to start by saying that I think that the thing that interested me the most in the Congress for Cultural Freedom to begin with was that I had never heard of it before. I read a book called Who Paid the Piper? But also, and it still basically never appears unless you really look or want to read about the CIA's politics or conspirational theories. It is not part of the general story of the Cold War or how the West won or anything. It's sort of for the people who are in the know, it's available, everything's available, but it doesn't appear. If you're interested in Jackson Pollock or George Orwell, you may know about it, but it's like a footnote. So how certain works were used politically is not really part of the story of these works. So when I did research into this, I felt I was looking at a parallel history or a shadow or something. It was like chasing a ghost. It was quite hard to get material. And a lot of what was written about it was quite boring because it was justifications or kind of very much in the time of the Cold War. It was also or buried in archives. This was before Google was a verb, so it was not accessible a lot, but I think it's still not very accessible. I think I was looking for a piece, something that would crack this open and sort of make it possible to integrate it into the image of the Cold War. I didn't really find that. So what I did were these two projects, and the publication is a reprint of one of the magazines that this Congress for Cultural Freedom published. This is the first issue that I made a facsimile of. It was published in 1953, and it had siblings all over the world. I have in this project concentrated on Western Europe because it's a part of the world I know. There was Der Monat in Germany, it was L'Épreuve in France. And I have basically left the publication, I think, yeah, as it was published then. I did some underlinings. And then in between the pages, I have inserted bits and pieces of my research, literally bits and pieces. There are photographs, there are some quotes, newspaper articles, book pages, some notes, and sometimes on the back sides of this I have added stories, quotes, pieces of interviews. And when I selected what to include in the publication, I thought of it as sort of a memory system, so that each of the spreads, each of the inserts reminds me of one aspect that I thought was relevant, interesting, important to this conspiration or this operation. So in a sense, behind each of these inserts, there is a much bigger story or series of events that I do not go into. I could have done probably a project on each of them. And then it will, even if you read all of it, I mean, you could read from any, you could start at any, you know, page or point and go crisscross or, you know, chronologically. It doesn't really matter. It's just pieces of a puzzle, and the full puzzle is not here. And it gives sort of the tip of the iceberg of a of something that I think even if you just glimpse it, it's kind of a huge thing, a big operation, a lot of work, a lot of resources, and a lot of people involved on very many different levels. And one of the things that I'm sorry, I don't have a thing in my... Can I drink from this? One of the things that are very What's fascinating, of course, is that an organization like the CIA, which of course is more known for military coups and surveillance and drugs and arms trades and stuff like that, had such great faith in art and culture. There is the contradiction, many contradictions that are produced throughout the kind of operation, as long as it lasts for almost two decades. And the major one is somehow to fight for freedom of expression with hidden means and with the help of a secret police, which is basically what it is. It's almost like they are, at the same time as they fight for this Western concept of freedom, unlimited freedom as the abstract expressionist, for instance, would symbolize, also saying that it's not free, the game is rigged, but we will have to deal with it. We will have to sort of buy that. Another question that is not maybe directly here, but that I had in my mind when I did it, was that what is the difference between this conspiracy or operation and any funding of art and intellectual work? You might say the secret police is a big difference, but Diana Josephson said to me, for instance, when I met her, that if the United States had had a Goethe Institute or a, you know, something like the British Art Council, my life would have been very different. My guess is that she wouldn't have been in this at all, because she and her husband didn't have the credentials that those institutions would have asked for. So I thought I would just, to end this, show you three of these inserts and speak a little bit about them. This is, I don't think you can really read it, but I will try to show it to you. This is a kind of beautiful flower of the how the funding from the CIA was distributed in the first decade of the Cold War. And this is like the different divisions. So it's North America, it's Africa, it's universities, lawyers, students, educators, Latin Americans, refugees, journalists, artists, women. Germany has its own column, which is probably this house was under this column. Research labor. So the art and culture part was a small part, even if it was also millions a year. And, of course, the question is, what role did it play? Did it play a role at all, or was this just, you know, an attempt? There is a quote from Thomas Braden that I also used here. He was the one who blew Michael Josephson cover. Basically, he was CIA major guy at the CIA when it was really good or powerful. And he says that in the first years, they were not accountable. So the CIA did not have to do any accounts. The only one who could ask them what they did with the suitcases of dollars that they brought around the world was a president. I mean, it's like a dream situation for any, I don't know, if the House of Grunewald could do that, you know, you could just give money to people that you thought would do a good work, would serve the cause. The other thing he said is that it was a multinational, and he says it probably was one of the first. And then I would like to show you, or I will not read the whole text because that's boring to listen to, but on the backside of this Time cover with T.S. Eliot from the 50s, I have printed a text by Allen Ginsberg, the U.S. poet. It's called T.S. Eliot Entered My Dreams. It's from 1978, and where he basically describes a meeting with T.S. Eliot on the fantail of a boat to Europe. And he asks T.S. Eliot what he thinks about the kind of CIA poetic conspiracies, and T.S. Eliot says that he doesn't think they are important at all. These are like a petty competition for dominance that you will always find. And Allen Ginsberg says that he thinks they were of some importance. It secretly nourished the careers of too many square intellectuals and provided sustenance to thinkers who influenced the intellectual tone of the West. The subsidiation of magazines like Encounter, which held Eliotic style as a touchstone for sophistication and competence, failed to create an alternative, free, vital, decentralized, individualistic culture. And then to end this, I will end with Michael Josephson. This is him in front of a banner in Milan in 56. Their albums were full of these images of different congresses and seminars that they had arranged. And in 1967, after the scandal or the shitstorm, as Michael Josephson would call it, he wrote to Steven Spender, who was a longtime editor of Encounter, that I was in a position to help hundreds of people all over the world to do what they themselves wanted to do, whether it was to write books, paint pictures, pursue certain studies, travel when and where they wanted to go, or edit magazines. All this I enjoyed doing. And if you think the CIA got anything out of it, believe me, the shoe was on the other foot. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Lene.
You're welcome.
Being in charge of this kind of ritual sometimes involves making unpleasant decisions. And there was a risk. But, you know, for the sake of the coherence of each singular argument, the question was whether to cut these presentations short to the time allotted, or since the coherence somehow fell into place between these presentations in ways that I think we could not all anticipate and have hoped for. That's how it is now, and I think just out of fairness to really the next panel, we need that break, because there's still a lot to come. So you will have to accept with me that there's no question and answers, and I welcome you back at 3:30 here for the second panel.